So as I said, we'll keep the question time for both presentations at the end. So now, so Jean-Philippe Béja, you know, who is trying to fight the fever, you know,
you know that fever.
Yeah, that you know that China, ever since the demise of Mao, you know, has been through a number of fevers, and now you have the Béja fever. let's listen to Jean-Philippe.
Well, thank you very much, Anne, and I'm very glad to be here, and I thank you for inviting me. Of course, after what Michel said, it's going to be difficult to talk about, to make you fear what's happening now in China, and to talk about the violence and the threat of violence. Because after all, you know, Max Weber used to say that the state is the one which has the monopoly of violence. And of course, in China, it was not always the case. And under Mao, especially, it was not the case. But what is legitimate violence? This can also be challenged. How can you call? You know, of course, Max Weber had a response. He had three types of legitimacies. Does this work all the time? What is legitimate? For example, recently in Hong Kong, you know, last week, there were peaceful demonstrations, and the police charged the peaceful demonstrators. And now they are challenging the state, saying this is not legitimate violence. The instruments of legitimate violence were used, but the violence was not legitimate. Politics is about violence or the threat of violence. So, I was going to start with presenting a little bit of what had happened during Mao's period, but I don't need to. Michel did it very clearly. I just add a couple of things, because he talked mostly of what is specific of Mao's violence. I don't completely agree with the fact that only in China everyone was part of the violence. I think it was the case in the Soviet Union. You know, one of the heroes of the Stalinist period is Pavel Kurchagin. Pavel Kurchagin is the son of a kulak, a rich peasant, who goes and denounces his parents, who are sent to the camps. And many people did that. Also in the Soviet Union. So on this, Mao was not such so creative, and he copied something from the Soviet Union. But of course, it was only part of it. The other aspect that there was is the instruments of social control, which are also very important in the totalitarian state, which was in China, the case of the Danwei, the work unit, the Dangan, the personal file, and the control exerted by the neighborhood committee, which is also something which prevents, which is a form of control. But anyway, hate, as Michel showed very clearly, hate of all against all, hate, class hatred, was at the center of the political violence and of the political system. It was part of its identity. You had a class identity. On your hukou was written, jiedi shenfen, what's your class, you know? And so people were asking me when I was a student in China, 75, what's your class origin? I said, well, I don't know, you know, maybe petty bourgeois, I guess. And so this was part of the identity. So when Mao died and the new leadership, which was still communist leadership, came to power, it reflected over this system and the abuses, the excesses it had led to, the tragedy of the Cultural Revolution. Because during just from 1978, let's say, until 1981, it was very, the party, encouraged people to criticize the Cultural Revolution and the last 20 years of Mao's reign. And the idea was to become more normal in order to be able to concentrate on the really, really important task, which was modernization of the country. They didn't use the expression yet, but it was achieving the China dream, achieving the dream of 1895, when China was defeated by Japan, by small Japan, it was Xiao Ruben, and that it had to take back its place in the world order, which is the first one. So you had to modernize. In order to modernize, you had to concentrate energies on something else than class hatred. And besides, class hatred had created lots of terrible consequences. So many people were rehabilitated, and party control over society, although it still existed, was relaxed. The party needed to renew its legitimacy, and so it needed some more possibilities for people to interact, to have new ideas, and in order to renew this legitimacy. And in the beginning it worked. So what were the means of violence that were to be used? Social control was not abolished. But it was not as effective in the early 80s because together with the state economy, which gave, you know, you were controlled by your danmei, everyone belonged to work unit, which could control your movements and your every action, there were some more, let's say, private ways to make a living, and especially in the countryside. Communes were de facto, you know, the people's communes were de facto destroyed in 84. And this allowed some leeway. So it allowed the peasants were able to move a little bit more freely than before. So social control was not as strong. So what do you need in order to maintain order? Well, you need things which are more classical, normal. In a way, it was a means of normalization. You use the police. You know, what was really striking in 70s China? You didn't see police. You know, you are in a country which is one of the most authoritarian in the world. You see a few soldiers, never with their weapons, and you don't see police, except sometimes at the crossroads. Why? You don't need them. Because totalitarian control is beyond police. You don't need police. People can't move without you knowing, without the authorities knowing. So there you saw some policemen arrive, police people, you know. So the creation, the emergence of police, paradoxically, ironically, appeared as a form of progress. Threat of violence, that is. Classical violence existed also under Mao. For example, the Tibetan uprising in 1959 was put down by the army. Classical, you know? It was just the army was sent there, they shot the insurgents and took over power. This is a classical way for any regime to enforce order. 1976, a demonstration after the death of Zhou Enlai, during Qingming, the dead festival, which saw 100,000 people go down to Tiananmen and ask for the end of feudalism and for to topple Qin Shi Huang. Qin Shi Huang was an emperor who ruled China in 2000 before Christ. You need to topple Qin Shi Huang.
200.
Yeah.
No, not 2000.
200 before Christ.
Oh,
200 BC.
200 BC, yes, yeah.
So, you see, this guy died some time ago, I guess. No, of course, Qin Shi Huang was Mao. How did they repress it? With the militias, in a way which is kind of, you know, normal, using clubs, things like that, arresting people, putting them in jail. So it existed also under Mao, but it became much more used, much more widespread after Mao's death, when the country started to normalize. Of course, when you use these kind of repressive institutions, tools to keep order, you all also have demonstrations, because you don't prevent them from occurring before they even come up in the head of the people. So in the 80s, there were demonstrations. There were demonstrations, there were students' demonstrations, there were Uyghur in Beijing and in Urumqi demonstrated against power. And these demonstrations were repressed by the police with arrests, with very heavy sentencing to prison for the leaders of these movements. But it went on and didn't prevent demonstrations from happening. So much so that when contradictions became much stronger, a big mass movement erupted in 1989. And for more than 50 days, first of all, there was a huge, there were demonstrations on Tiananmen after the death of Hu Yaobang, which gathered tens of thousands of students. And then the party decided that this was too much and published an editorial. An editorial which said, this movement is manipulated by a small minority of anti-socialist forces. This, under Mao, was enough to make people go back home. Nothing would happen, you know. And so when the People's Daily editorial came out, everybody thought, so much for the movement, it's okay. And then the contrary happened. People who were 20 years old hadn't really been through the whole Cultural Revolution. They didn't know fear so much as their parents. And the day after the editorial was published, they decided to go down to the street. And there were more than 100,000 people going to the streets, applauded by the Beijing population. The movement spread to many cities in China. There were demonstrations everywhere. And even worse, you know, police went to demonstrate with their discontent on the on Tiananmen Square. The movement lasted, Tiananmen was occupied, and there were lots of such movements all over the country, in more than 200 cities in the country. So what was the regime going to do? You know, it was very hard to go back to Mao's recipe, mobilize the people against the people. They tried it. They tried it. At the end of May, there were two demonstrations organized by the party in the suburbs of Beijing, with peasants saying, we want to restore order, we are against the loi, you know, the disorder all around, so we have to put an end to that. Wow, that was absolutely nothing, you know. No one continued. The vast masses of the people were remaining there, preventing the army from coming into the city. So, once again, what did the party do? It, you know, a colleague of ours recently was telling there was a military coup. And I had been opposed to this idea of a military coup. But actually, if you look at what really happened, in the last resort, when you need to restore order, you use the army. And so Deng Xiaoping as the chief of the army. He was then, his only position was the head of the military, the Central Military Committee. And he sent the army, and they used tanks and started shooting people, and through the massacre, which, as Anne was saying, didn't occur, killed more than 1,000 people in the capital, in Beijing, and restored order, as order was restored in Warsaw in 1848, you know? So this, in a way, is also a symbol of the normalization of the regime. That's ironical, that's paradoxical, but you know, it's very much like what happened earlier, in 1979 in Taiwan with the Melida incident, in Gwangju, in Korea with the Gwangju incident. So the Tiananmen massacre is very similar to the Gwangju massacre, to the Melida Formosa massacre. So that means China is becoming a normal country. That's why many people say it's an authoritarian country. That's where many people made a huge mistake, because this is not what happened. Because what we are going to see now is trying to see what is happening now. 30 years after the Tiananmen massacre, we are heading towards something which is more like a friend of ours calls digital totalitarianism. No big massacres, no huge roundups of thousands of people, except for Xinjiang, but I'm going to talk of Xinjiang specifically. But in a way, it's a targeted repression which is targeted towards the leaders of what could be a challenging civil society, and enforcement of all-out control. All-out control using, and it's a modern enforcement of symbolic violence. We are not talking about physical violence. There is some physical violence, but it's not preeminent. Symbolic violence. So, social credit, which allows the authorities, the dream of the panopticon, which is the totalitarian dream, Big Brother, or Aldous Huxley's Best of Worlds. Whatever you do, you know, there used to be, it's, in a way, it's not a very big difference from what was happening in the 50s, you know. It's just the industrialization, the modernization of the tools of social control. Instead of the Juehui Lao Tai Tai, you know, the old lady from the neighborhood committee who was watching you and writing what you were doing, who you were seeing, and all that. Instead of your workshop chief who was writing what your thoughts were, what you have is the internet, you know, using all sorts of digital ways to know what you do. And you do it, it's voluntary servitude. You use your phone to do anything. You use your phone to take the Jianguo app, you know, the strong country app, and you get points. You can buy things in an easier way. So whatever you do, you yourself, you're going around with your phone, and the authorities know where you are, who you see, what you do. When you're paying, they know if you are trying to be a crook, if you're a crook or not, if you pay your debts or not, if you pay your bills or not. So this, I mean, it's not yet absolutely done, but there is, it's in the plan. In 2020, this should be generalized. Of course, you know, China is China, and the bureaucracy is the bureaucracy. So it won't be done in 2020, but it might be done in 2023. Anyway, everybody, all the artificial intelligence companies in our countries are also collaborating. to the establishment of this kind of control. So this is one of the instruments of what I call symbolic violence, which is social control on an industrial way. But you also have classical repression. You take, you know, for example, civil right lawyers. Take civil right lawyers, and what do? You arrest 300 people, you threaten 275, you keep 25. You keep these 25 and torture, no. It's not the kind of torture, you know, I'm going to put you, to attach you there and all that. It happens also, but this is only for ordinary dissidents or criminals. For these well-known lawyers, you treat their disease. Wang Chengzhang doesn't have high blood pressure, but he's been taking pills against high blood pressure for a year during his incarceration. What happened? He can't remember what he did before. Li Heping had absolutely no disease. He was treated for a depression. Li Heping went into jail with a completely black hair, came out of jail 2 years later, his hair was completely white. You know, there's an old communist opera called the Bai Maonia, the white-haired lady, who's every Chinese kid knows about this hero. Well, you know, now you can have Bai Maonan, and that's Li Heping. So these are the usual. And then I'll just finish with what's happening in Xinjiang. Everyone has heard about these vocational training centers which have been created in Xinjiang, where about 1 million people are, a million people are re-educated, you know. Maybe you've seen recently there was a program on the BBC where they were invited to visit a camp. And the people learn, you know, as soon as, for example, if you don't eat pork, if you pray five times a day, if you have a long beard, if you have a hijab, you might be a splittist. So you will be taken to these camps and you will be taught Chinese and what they call Chinese history, which is basically 没有共产党，没有新中国. Without the Communist Party, there would be no new China. Maybe these people would rather have no new China, but they're not asked about that. And so I'm not saying that these are concentration camps, although at the beginning, the Chinese spokesperson for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs did call them concentration camps. And then he said, no, not at all. It's vocational training center. And these people are...
Vocational.
Kind of vocational training. Yeah. So there are 1 million people. But not, this is not not enough. Cadres, Han cadres very often, or trustworthy Uyghur cadres are sent to families which are suspected of having splittist tendency. Having splittist tendency, if your son goes abroad to study, to France is bad, but Turkey or Saudi Arabia or Egypt is even much worse. These people will settle down in these families. And, you know, in the old tradition of the People's Liberation Army, where soldiers used to live with the peasants, well, now these cadres are living with the Uyghurs and seeing how they are behaving. So violence, physical violence, is something which is, of course, obnoxious and terrible, but the kind of violence which is now enforced in China is much more pernicious. And much less visible than it was during the Cultural Revolution. But how about, what about its influence on the training of people, the formation of people, education of Chinese citizens, who during the last 30 years have been raising their level of awareness, of rights awareness? I think this is something which we have to really observe in the coming years. And this is something which concerns every one of us, not only the Uyghurs, not only the Chinese, but also all of us. Thank you.